Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and the nature of consciousness. We offer a myriad of support and services through our organization Toward the Light, not least of which is this radio program. For more information about our work, please visit our websites towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info. A very quick announcement that I would like to make: next Saturday, 24th May, we are having our Light on the Water near-death experience support and discussion group meeting via teleconference. It will be from 9 to 11 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. So please join us again. That's for the Light on the Water near-death support and interest group meeting next Saturday, 24th May, at 9 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. This week, I am very pleased to have the author of a wonderful book. I would call it a must-read. It is entitled The Spiritual Brain by Dr. Mario Beauregard. Let us welcome to Toward the Light, Mario Beauregard. Hello, Mario.
Hello.
It is very nice to have you with us on Toward the Light, and I'm very excited about this book. I've been reading it and really appreciating it in a huge way. What I would like to do, I know that you are a neuroscientist, and I would like to ask you, what prompted you to write this book? I think it's very interesting, and of course I'm going to have some good questions to pass your way here about this topic, because it's very relevant for sure. What got you into the writing of this book? What led you to research consciousness outside of the brain?
Personal spiritual experiences that I've had since my early childhood. So that was the starting point. And also the fact that there are many lines of evidence out there indicating that the mainstream view in current neuroscience, which is very materialist and also reductionist, is erroneous. So in the book, we've tried to present all kinds of evidence showing that this current view of neuroscience, which is trying to reduce human beings to sophisticated biological robots and everything that is mental and also spiritual to electrical and chemical processes in the brain, well, this view is wrong. And but the starting point was a series of spiritual experiences that I've had very early.
So you were having spiritual experiences as a child yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then what got you into neuroscience?
Well, I was when I was about 8 years old, I started to be fascinated by the mind-brain question, mind-brain relationships, and also the question of the soul, spirituality. And I decided then to become a scientist and to be able to investigate these fascinating questions.
So this is actually something that occurred as a result of your own experiences, and then you wanted to glean a deeper understanding of that, and then ultimately to share it with others.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's quite brilliant, and of course, being both a multiple NDE and other transformative experiences, as well as a researcher, I really have to say that I resonate with your conclusions. And we should talk about this because, of course, I find and I really like the term that you use, materialist, because that's exactly what it is, a materialist. To me, it would appear quite daft that people would think that consciousness is, and especially, for example, what we in the ears experience as a product of the brain. You know, just common sense would say, well, how can that be when we have actually qualified the terms of being clinically dead. In other words, no pulse, no brainwave activity, and no breath. So how can this be the product of a dying brain if the brain isn't even active, plus the fact that our experiences and our vantage point are way outside of the physical body and outside of the physical brain? So let's talk about some of your findings, because, again, this is just common sense to me, being an experiencer. What were some of the things that you did that led you to understand that these are not products of a dying brain?
Well, I decided to study near-death experiencers, and because it's a very interesting field for someone who's interested in the mind-brain relationships. And so I researched the field, and I also studied a number of near-death experiencers in my own lab. Recently, we completed a project with 15 near-death experiencers, and as you know, there are many aspects or components involved in these experiences, and one of the central component is the encounter with the light, or a being of light, as some experiencers say. And so we studied near-death experiencers who were able to, well, first of all, they all went to this encounter with the light or being of light. And secondly, since that experience, they all claimed that they were able to be in daily communication with this light. And for most of the experiencers that I met, the light is equivalent of our concept of God, if you will, but not necessarily in a Christian sense, but more like the intelligent source at the origin of everything in our universe.
Yes.
So these people can enter into a sort of meditative state, and in that state they communicate. They get into a state of union with the light. So we used two different brain imaging technologies. One is called EEG, for electroencephalography. And this technique allows us to measure electrical activity in the brain. The other brain imaging technology is called functional magnetic resonance imaging imaging technique. And this technique allows us to visualize which regions of the brain, and also the neural networks, that are activated during all sorts of tasks. So it can be a cognitive task, like a memory, for instance, or can be perception or an emotional task. But it can also be spiritual states or spiritual experiences. So it was very interesting, because with EEG, we noticed that these people were able to produce a lot of very slow waves in their brain. So slow waves like theta waves. The frequency of these waves range between 4 to 8 cycles per second, or hertz. And they were also able to produce a lot of delta waves. These waves range from 0.5 to about 4 cycles per second. And interestingly, we see normally these waves during the delta waves during deep sleep, and also during coma state. And for the theta waves, you will normally see these waves just before the people will fall asleep, and they are associated with the retrieval of material from the unconscious, and also with creativity. And usually this state is associated with a marked alteration of the state of consciousness. So it was very interesting to see these people, these near-death experiencers, producing this kind of wave while they were totally awake in our lab. So that was interesting. And with the fMRI technology, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, we were able to identify the brain regions involved in such state. And the regions that were activated are very similar to the regions we saw activated in a previous study that was done with Carmelite nuns, cloistered nuns, actually, we're in a state of a mystical state of union with God. We did this experiment 3 years ago.
I was going to ask you about that. You said you conducted this 3 years ago?
Yes, with the nuns, and with the near-death experiencers, the project was completed last year, but we have not published yet the results. It's coming. But it's very interesting to see the similarities between these two states. So the brain regions that are activated and also the brainwave activity that change during such a deep meditative state, they are what we call correlates. So correlates refer to a phenomenon that will accompany another phenomenon. So it doesn't mean that the brain activity that changes during that state is the source, if you will, of the phenomenon. So it's more like a mediation by the brain of something else. So it's like if there's a shift in terms of electrical and chemical activity in the brain that allows a communication with another plane of existence, if you will.
Well, I noticed in your book you mentioned some names of people who've been on my show, and they're absolutely tremendous, and I'm so appreciative of them. Dr. Tim van Lommel,
yes,
from the Netherlands, and then also Dr. Peter Finnick.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The wonderful thing that both of these men point out is the fact, and Dr. Peter Finnick especially was talking about this quite a lot down in his lectures, which are also featured on my website, towardthelight.org. Actually, Dr. Van Lommel and also Peter Finnick are both featured on the site. Peter was pointing out that the NDE actually occurs when there's absolutely no brainwave activity whatsoever. In other words,
yes.
Physically dead.
For instance, if experience associated with a cardiac arrest,
yes.
Well, the blood circulation stops. Normally, the EEG will become flat after 10 to 15 seconds. So there's no apparent brain activity anymore.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, it seems to me that even that right there is proof, well, consciousness does exist very lucidly and clearly.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of no brain activity going on. And there was an article, Amanda Cable is the woman's name, and she was dealing with a tubular pregnancy, and I can't remember what the medical term is for that, but they had to conduct a surgical procedure, where they actually made her brain dead, and they had to drain her body of all blood.
Oh, yes, it's called a standstill surgery.
Okay.
And it's done to remove major aneurysm at the base of the brain, in the brainstem region normally.
Yeah.
There's a famous case of a woman called, well, that's not her real name, but Pam Reynolds. I don't know if you heard about
her. Oh, yes, I've heard of her, sure.
Oh, okay.
A fellow NDE.
So this one, good illustration of such surgery, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes.
So it's very interesting because in that kind of surgery, you induce a clinical death for a certain period of time. Normally, it's between 15 to 60 minutes at worst. And the neurosurgeons will try to remove or to repair what they call the aneurysm, which is a swollen blood vessel, which threatens to burst at any time, and usually if it bursts, then it's lethal. And so about 30 years ago, they devised this procedure, so they cool down the body, and they stop totally the blood circulation, and the heart to stop as well, and so the person, of course, does not have any brain activity for that period of time. And in the case of Pam Reynolds, it was very interesting because she was able to report veridical information about the dialogues between the neurosurgeons and the nurses and cardiologists. And she was also able to draw very accurately some of the surgical instruments that were used in this intervention. And at a later point during her experience, she had the impression of leaving her physical body. And she reported that she had the impression of traveling along a tunnel at very high speed. And at the other end of the tunnel, she met with deceased relatives and friends. And in the final component of her experience, she met with the famous light or being of light, and her life was totally changed. But it's the first time that we have a case like this where we know for sure that there was no brain activity, and yet she was able to, well, she was conscious, she was able to perceive, to feel emotionally. And so it's this case, but there are also other cases as well, strongly support the view that mind and consciousness can operate independently of the physical brain.
Well, this has been my stance for a long time, for obvious reasons, and this was also too with Amanda Cable, and what happened with her, as well as reporting back a lot of the dialogues going on in the operating theatre and all of that. She also saw her daughter, her five-year-old daughter, in school, and her daughter took her for a tour in the school. Mind you, she had, this was her daughter's first day in school, so she had no idea what the daughter's uniform looked like or the school or anything else, because she'd been in hospital. Well, she reported back everything accurately about her daughter's school, her daughter's uniform, and what was going on in the operating theater. And she had the exact same situation, no brainwave activity, no heartbeat, nothing. She was clinically totally dead. So that's why when I've been reading your book, it's made me very excited, because I can't understand the reductionist and materialist insistence that consciousness comes from the brain, whereas Tim Van Lommel, Dr. Peter Finnick, David Icke, who's another brilliant researcher, and a number of us NDEers, all, you know, again, through common sense and research and experience, conclude that consciousness is not a part of the physical brain, but the physical brain is just like the receiver. We give it the analogy of a radio or television.
Yeah. So, yeah, but the problem is that materialism has become synonymous with science, unfortunately. But
yes,
it should not be like this. But now, materialism is the central dogma of most physical science, and including neuroscience. And so, if you dare challenging this paradigm, well, it can be very negative for your career, and you're taking chance, because it's like a church, really, like it was centuries ago. And so we're in that kind of situation, and that is why all the evidence presented against this materialistic worldview are not well received at all. And the major editors of important journals systematically refuse to, to let their journals present these evidence, because there's no objectivity involved in this process. Really. So it's more a matter of ideology, of belief systems, unfortunately, because science should not be like that. Well, objectivity is supposed to be at the heart of the scientific method.
Mm-hmm. So it's like fundamentalism.
Exactly. That's the same principle.
It's sort of like they're saying, don't bother me with the facts, my mind is already made up.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I'm baffled that they could still conclude or have such conclusions the way they do in light of all of the evidence to the contrary. And so I was wondering, what you have been able to share with them. And again, I know for a fact, and it's true with myself, it took me, about 25 years before I had my coming out, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden I was all over the press and everything else with the fact that I'm an NDE and a multiple NDE. And another interesting thing about that is that whilst I was in coma, and I was in coma for about 6 weeks, and then also lost all of my vital signs as well for one of my near-death experiences, but I did not experience unconsciousness. from my vantage point.
Right.
So, and I guess when I was in coma, my brain was still technically working on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And an interesting thing with that, too, is that I was in the intensive care unit, and there was another woman in comatose next to me. So we were both in deep stage comas,
mm-hmm.
and yet we were communicating with each other on the other dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So, what might you see as a neuroscientist in your EEGs, and what is that? The MRIs?
Yes, functional MRIs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, when you're in a deep coma, the brain is not functioning properly, so you see only very slow wave activity, for instance. So it's and in that state, like Dr. Fenwick was saying, the brain is not able to function normally, and you're not supposed to be able of to have cognitive processes like perception or memory, or you're not supposed to be able to feel or to be conscious at all. And yet, this is not what is reported by the patients who have been in that state, by many people. So your case is not unique, because we hear these things quite often, but they cannot be received yet within the traditional framework of neuroscience.
They're so
totally rejected
to
because they're not supposed to be possible, so, which is very sad.
So this, you know, this is like still insisting that the Earth is flat.
Exactly, we're in the same situation. Yes.
What is their payoff for having these, you know, this unwillingness to grow with the research?
Acceptance and recognition from the scientific community. Otherwise, you're a black sheep. You're an heretic, and because you want to change the prevailing view, the paradigm. So it's the same thing then with Copernic and Galileo, and you know,
mm-hmm.
it's the same kind of situation exactly. But there's mounting evidence, you know, all the time, increasingly, and it's only a matter of time now, because it's clear that there will be a major paradigm shift. I don't know in how many years or decades, but it's coming for sure. Because that's how the worldviews change usually. Because there will be an accumulation of facts, of evidence, you know, challenging or showing, you know, the current paradigm is flawed, and that's how science is progressing.
Well,
so that's part of natural process.
And I think that's already started to happen because.
Oh yes, totally.
In a huge way.
But if you are among the pioneers who are challenging the current view, well then you risk of losing your status and your research money and funding, and so you know it's a risky business, and so that's why most people prefer not to do this.
Well, I actually know some physicians who've been involved with the International Association for Near-Death Studies, for example,
mm-hmm.
but they won't tell their colleagues about it.
No, exactly. You see, that's a good example of what I'm saying.
And yet people like yourself and Van Lommel and
mm-hmm.
Peter Fenwick, you know, you've just done such wonderful work, and I, from the bottom of my heart, I've got to commend you for this work, because...
Mm-hmm.
You are the bright lights. You are indeed a pioneer who, you know, in my way of thinking, you are being true to science, because science to me
mm-hmm.
should be about research and discovery.
Exactly.
And then implementing what you have discovered
mm-hmm.
and applying it. So, and I also should think that this would be a source of great comfort for the whole of the global community, because
mm-hmm.
I have seen that, you know, when I've contemplated this, you know, there's this whole thing of people being afraid of death, which actually doesn't exist. It's an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more than that, people are afraid of the unknown.
Right.
And so people keep everything mystified and you know, and by going into denial, sorry, and you mentioned this in the book too, all of this stuff about denial, goodness me. And yet, you know, as people are in denial about the fact that there is life after death, and so many of us have continued to prove it, some of us numerous times, this should help to remove the stigma and the fear associated with so-called death. So I think people like you are really wonderful to take these chances, and I'm not getting any sense that your career is threatened. It feels to me like quite the contrary. You're making great speeds.
Yes, because we are already in the transition process toward a new worldview at that level, and so there's some openness now, and you can dare, you know, writing books and giving lectures and starting to challenge this this materialistic worldview, and people will, well, they won't burn you because they are not allowed to do this anymore, but they secretly, covertly, very often, they are on your side, but they cannot go out publicly and say that. So that's what I've noticed, because privately, I speak very often with colleagues, and they will tell me, well, keep going. It's what you're doing is important, but I wouldn't do it myself, but, you know, but they cannot see that they're allowed to say that publicly because they're afraid of losing their status or their research money and stuff like that. So, but in reality, I've noticed that the hard-nosed materialists and reductionists only represent a minority of people around the world, but they are very vocal. They are very well-known, and if you take the case of a scientist like Richard Dawkins, for instance, in Great Britain, or Daniel Dennett, the philosopher in the United States, and these people, they are not numerous, but they have a lot of exposure. You see, so it gives a false picture of the current state, because in reality, there are very few people thinking like they do.
Well, and that's the good news, because I know recently when I was reading a book by Susan Blackmore, I thought, well, I should do that, even though I knew from everything I heard from her was just simply ludicrous. And I found myself being so frustrated because, again, she's got a very myopic view of reality. And reality is not, you know, and again, I'm just speaking from my own experience and understanding that reality is not confined to the material world, far from. In fact, I regard the material world as more of a hologram, or like a hologram, and that reality exists in a myriad of dimensions and frequencies. And I think that as we've come to understand that everything is energy, and that energy vibrates at different frequencies, that's going to give you your different planes of existence. So, And the interesting thing with this, too, is that people like PMH Atwater, and again, the people that we've been talking about, and yourself, have all independently and simultaneously come up with the same analogies, again, regarding the brain as a receiver, not the broadcaster.
Yeah, exactly.
So would you like to elaborate on that a little bit, how, you know, what you've done and how you come to these conclusions, not the least of which has been your own mystical and what we call spiritually transformative experiences?
Yes, well, it's based on my own research, but also with the nuns, for instance, and also the in the years, and but also the work done by other researchers like Stanislas Grof, for instance, the work he did with psychedelic drugs first, and then with breathing after that to induce altered states of consciousness. And so if you take all together the findings of all those research, it's clear that the brain does not produce consciousness, but it's more like a mediator or a transponder. And this idea is not new, because it was proposed first by William James, the father of American psychology, about a century ago. And James objectively studied various lines of evidence, even including trans mediumship and stuff like that. And he concluded that the brain was not producing mind and consciousness, but it was more acting as a transmitter. And after that, Dr. Wilder Penfield, the American neurosurgeon who founded the Montreal Neurological Institute, he did a series of studies about electrical stimulation of the brain in epileptic patients. And he concluded that based on a series of experiments done over a few decades, that the brain was acting like a transponder also. So it's like if you can stimulate the brain, and it will allow the retrieval, for instance, of unconscious memories. So that's what he found in his studies. But the memories themselves are not stored within the physical brain. So it's, they can exist, but like informational field outside the physical brain. But these fields seem to interact with the brain, and that is what is now proposed by Dr. Van Lommel, also in the Netherlands.
Yes, he wrote a book that's been published, and I can't remember the name of it because it's in Dutch, but that...
Right.
There is an English version of it due out, I believe, in a year.
Yes, that's what he told me.
Okay, he told me that too, and so I'm very excited about that because he's doing such tremendous work. And again, you know, it's a huge bell there, as it were, to try to remove the stigma and the fear around all of this.
Yes.
And another really important point that you make in your book that I want to bring up is that you were discussing some kind of helmet that somebody could put on.
Oh, yes, the so-called God helmet. Yeah,
yes,
it's been developed by Dr. Michael Persinger. Yeah, he's based at Laurentian University in Ontario, Canada. And, he reasoned that if it's possible to... for epileptic patients to have religious spiritual experiences during the seizures, and when the seizures are located within a region of the brain that we call the temporal lobe on the side, then he thought that it would be possible in principle to induce these experiences by stimulating this region of the brain with very weak electromagnetic currents. So he devised a helmet that the journalist called the God helmet. And he claims that it's possible with this helmet to induce very systematically, in all kinds of people, in religious or spiritual experiences or even out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences. And so that's what he's been claiming for decades. But in reality, it's not very clear because his research is very flawed. There are many problems, including the fact that he's investigating his own students, for instance. And a few years ago, a group of Swedish researchers decided to test this helmet and the claims of Persinger, and they totally controlled for the placebo effect because the participants in Persinger experiments, they know in advance the goal of the experiment, usually. And like I said, there are students, bachelor students, who know him or who are part of the program at Laurentian University in psychology. And in Sweden, they did something very different. They totally controlled for this possibility of suggestibility. And so they created a sham group, a control group, and they... when they did that, they realized that there was no effect at all of the electromagnetic currents. So it appears that it's not possible to systematically induce these experiences in people, all kinds of people. And so contrary to the claims of Persinger and his colleagues, and But he's still claiming this, and as he appears in numerous documentaries. And but he's doing this because he's another materialist and atheist, and he's trying to destroy religion and spirituality because, as he wrote, religion, for instance, is a cognitive virus. That's what he used as an expression. And so he's on a mission, if you will, and so he's not objective at all regarding these questions.
It would appear not. And then there's, you know, people have also, I can't remember the name of the drug, but there's a drug also that people are supposed to, it's purportedly supposed to reproduce a near-death experience.
Oh, it's ketamine.
Thank you.
And it's been used by Dr. Carl Janssen in London. He's a psychiatrist. And at first, that's what he was claiming. But then he had himself an NDE, and he changed totally his view regarding this question. So now he's
not good. I think so. Because these things can't be artificially induced. Now, an interesting point, though.
But it's true that if you change the electrical and chemical activity in the brain, it can be done artificially. For instance, if you take a psychedelic drug like LSD, well, during that state, because the activity of the brain is totally changed, it's possible for the experiencer to have access to another realm of reality, a spiritual dimension. But the problem with these drugs usually is that you don't have any control, and there are side effects, of course. So,
yeah.
It's true that it's possible to have genuine spiritual experiences when you take these compounds.
Well, I thought so too, in a way, because some of them can actually open portals to other dimensions.
Yes, that's my point, exactly.
Okay.
Yes, so that's why the shamans, for instance, have been using some herbs for, you know, thousands of years now, and because they discovered this a long, long time ago.
Well, there's the one that people in South America, Ayahuasca, is that how it's pronounced?
Yes, yeah. Ayahuasca.
Ayahuasca, okay.
Or Yagi, yeah.
And that's a very, very powerful herb. And,
right.
And then, the Native Americans in America use peyote and stuff like that.
Right.
And then there's mushrooms. And I do agree that, you know, when they're used with all due respect, that they can help trigger what I would call an opening up so that people can access higher awareness. But it can also be done without anything inducing it. And I think you are one person who've spontaneously had these spiritually transformative experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Are you at liberty to share any of them, or what maybe led you into one? Were you doing a meditation, or were you just doing something?
No. I was living in the countryside, and my father was a farmer, and we had a lot of space, and we didn't have a lot of people around, so I had, you know, a lot of time to think and reflect, walking through the fields and the forests, and so that's, I was in touch a lot with nature.
Yeah.
And so that's how I've had my my first experiences. And for some of these experiences, it was a state of a cosmic state of consciousness, if you will. And so it's like in that state you become at one with everything in the universe, and you realize that your own little self is not does not represent your true identity.
Exactly. Yes.
And these experiences have very long-lasting effects, usually, and positive effects, usually. And they are very powerful. So for me, these experiences were extremely powerful, and they are the main reasons why I'm doing the kind of research I'm doing today. Now I'm 45, and I started to have these experiences when I was 8 years old, you see, so it was a long, long time, and yet they still exert a very powerful influence over my life.
Well, that's a very good point, too, and I've been going through this lifelong, you know, throughout my life as well, and you make some very interesting points about mysticism and these transcendent experiences, and you do have that connection with all that is, and I go to this too, just spontaneously happen. I could be just sitting, and because I've always been a contemplative myself, and even been in monasteries like the Carmelites, even though I'm not a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But I so deeply resonate with the contemplative life. The other interesting point with all of this, you know, unlike the claims of medical science, with a deprived brain being deprived of oxygen or what have you, you know, we're supposed to become damaged and a little bit loopy around the edges and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, what's ended up happening is that people, as a result of having near-death and similar experiences, even those who've just gone into comatose, would come back being much more brilliant,
mm-hmm.
more sensitive, everything perfectly intact, and furthermore, as you pointed out, having total recall of their experiences
mm-hmm.
that do not die with the passage of time. Now, that is very, very different from hallucinations.
Totally.
Because, you know, when people hallucinate, they don't have the clarity. And also, as Dr. Finnick was pointing out, too, when people have deathbed visions,
yes,
they can be in the midst of this communion with a deceased friend or loved one or what have you, and then turn to you and have a very clear conversation
mm-hmm.
with you, just like having a conversation with two people in a room. It doesn't lose him anything going back and forth to conversing with you and then conversing to the individual he or she's in contact with on the other side. So there's a real radical difference between this kind of stuff and having hallucinations. And I'm sure even if something is being recorded in the brain, that would be very different. Now, would you have a way of explaining how it is that the brain does not end up becoming damaged as a result of near-death experiences and deep comatose states?
Well, if there are natural mechanisms for the brain allowing to protect itself to a certain extent. So usually we say that you cannot have be clinically dead for more than 15 to 20 minutes, because after that you will experience major damage at the brain level. But the near-death experiences research tell us that it's not true at all.
Exactly.
But we don't understand why. In some cases we know, because for instance, somebody falling into very cold weather, well, when the body temperature is decreased, it will help preserve the tissue. So this is one explanation, but in some cases we don't have any good explanation. But, I have a case of a well-known case, a case of Mellon Thomas Benedict. I don't know if you heard of this.
Oh, man. Absolutely, sure.
Okay, so in this case he was dead for about 90 minutes, 1 hour and 30 minutes, and so medically it does not make any sense, especially because he died of brain cancer, and so the brain was in a terrible state when he died. But when he came back, there was no trace anymore of this brain cancer. So in those cases, we don't have any good medical explanation, because there's clearly something else involved in these recuperation, and in deep states of coma, it's exactly the same thing. So the medical doctors do not understand very well these phenomena, and clearly there are other factors implicated. And when I'm saying this, I'm referring to on the spiritual side, for sure.
Well, George Horton Iyer is a very good example of one who was literally dead for 3 days.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and he's not the only one who's literally dead for 3 days. There's been
mm-hmm.
a number of people, and yet he just came back such a bright and shining
yes.
soul,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there's also the fact that fear is completely removed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once we've been through these experiences, although I have to say that I've never had a fear of death, but then I've toggled between life and death ever since I've been alive. So, you know, we're mm-hmm. looking since the 40s now, actually. And it's very interesting to me that so many experiences come back very, very intelligent, increased psychic ability, increased
right.
sensitivities.
Mm-hmm. More compassion and empathy.
Absolutely.
Also.
Yes, and very much the desire, like myself, I'm a perpetual student. I feel like I've been in university all my life, you know. And so this is something very, very powerful. And I would like to ask you, do you have any workshops or presentations that you're going to be giving anytime soon? Or?
Well, I gave a few lectures based on the book, The Spiritual Brain, in United States and Canada since last fall. But I don't have any schedule. But every time, so it does not happen very frequently, but I know that when I present a lecture somewhere, the house, the room is always full, you know. So I've presented in front of a few thousand people in France, I remember, one time. And so the people are really fascinated by these questions all over the world. And so, I'd like to do this more, but, I'm not very good at organizing things. So I don't know how to establish a schedule, you know, and traveling and all these things. I would need some help at that level, but, I would like to do this more because, it's important for people to realize that they are not biological robots, totally determined by their genes, then their neurons, and that they are more than this, and that death is not the end of anything because it's only a transition towards something different. And it's very important for people to know this because it can dramatically change their lives. You know, so
well, that's the whole point of this work, and I'm so grateful. For example, David Icke gave a beautiful analogy of the human body being a biological computer.
Yes.
And as well, the computer can break and all of that. If it doesn't work, but it's still got an operator.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so it's if you take the case of Alzheimer's disease, for instance, the soul, the essence of the person has not vanished, but it's the interaction, you know, of the mind, mental processes and consciousness with the brain, the hardware, which is totally disturbed because it's the same thing if you alter you change some transistors in your TV set. Of course, the reception of the program will be totally disturbed, but the TV station keeps emitting, you know, the programmation is stays exactly the same, but it's the of course the output which is different. So it's a good analogy.
I think it's an excellent one, and in fact, in my blog, intolight@blogspot.com, one of the articles I wrote it was in response to a question, and it's called A Case of Recognition. I believe that's what the title of it is. I forget at the moment. But anyway, a woman is asking about the fact that her mum had Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw a picture of a wedding picture, and she couldn't recognize her husband. She said, "Who's that man?" And so, you know, the daughter, of course, was very brokenhearted. And she said, well, if she had a near-death experience, would she recognize her husband? You know, and I told her, the very thing that you were explaining, I said it is only her brain and not her own consciousness that has been disturbed. And, of course, when she does transition from her body, she and her consciousness will be fully intact. And, of course, she will recognize her husband. It's just the mechanism that filters the information on the third dimensional plane that is afflicted. But she, in fact, is not. So I really appreciate people like you. And, of course, last week I was speaking with Dr. Claude Swanson, who's another scientist he's a physicist who's been doing amazing research pointing out the validity of telepathy and extrasensory sensory perception. on the fact that we are multidimensional beings living in a multiverse. And so I really want to encourage all of you wonderful scientists who are willing to take that chance and come forward with the truth, because in my way of thinking, truth is more important than status.
Yes, I agree.
And I really believe with all of my heart that you are the ones who are going to rise up high because of the love in your heart and the willingness to take these chances and speak the truth, because really, again, and I think it's just such common sense. Mm-hmm. You know, so many of us have been able to come forward and share things that there's no way it could have come just through the brain, because mm-hmm. the brain was dead. It wasn't working. Mm-hmm. But we do remain conscious entities in spite of a brain lost or damaged or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, your work is tremendous, and I've got your book on my blog and on my website. You have now not only got a presence on the, the University of Montreal?
Of Montreal, yes.
You've got a website on there, but now you've got a page on towardthelight.org. If people go to towardthelight.org /Mario Beauregard, you'll be present there as well. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners? I know that you said you had limited time, but as long as you're willing to talk to us, I'm very pleased to have you with us.
Well, we now I'm involved in a project with Dr. Fennick and Dr. Van Lommel, and also Dr. Sam Parnia, another researcher in the field of near-death experience. And we would like to demonstrate the for consciousness the independence, relative independence from brain activity. And to do this, we're going to use what I was talking about earlier, the standstill surgery. So now this form of surgery is used in major hospital centers around the world. For instance, here in Montreal, it's done about 25 to 30 times every year at a major hospital. And so we thought that if it's true that consciousness can operate independently of the brain, then it should be possible in principle for the people during that state of surgery to be able to identify some targets,
yes.
Hidden targets. So we're going to put targets, electronic targets, under the form of emotionally laden images during the surgery, while the brain will not be functioning anymore. So that would be one way of demonstrating this thing, because so far we have anecdotal evidence, like the case of Pam Reynolds, for instance, but there has not been any experimental study of this phenomenon yet during that state, the state of cardiac arrest. So that's one major goal, and so we are trying to set up this experiment now, and we're trying to find some money also to finance this project. But it will be a fascinating project, because it's the first time in the history of modern science that something like that will happen. And we don't know the incidence of the phenomenon, so we don't know when the heart is stopped artificially. We don't know how many people experience an NDE. There's no statistic about this yet, so we're going to collect data about this also.
I know that's difficult, because when Dr. Van Lommel and I were talking, he was on the show, I believe it was in October, and Dr. Fennick was on in September.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Fennett was talking about this process of experimentation that you're describing.
Yes.
Back then he was talking about they'd already set up a number of these targets in various
hospitals. Yes, for the people having cardiac arrest while they are at the hospital. But the cardiac arrest in that condition is not induced artificially. It's people suffering from heart problems, and when they happen to be at the hospitals, We know that the likelihood for them to experience a cardiac arrest is quite high. So this is a project that has been created by Dr. Fennick and Dr. Parnia. And about 10 hospital centers in UK participate this this project. But there are now there's this other project which involves the standstill surgery. So that will be another exciting project also.
Well, I know that both of them have pointed out to me too, because it's the statistics for NDEs who've had cardiac arrest is rather vague, and one reason is because a number of them, well, two reasons. Some of them are just too timid or uncomfortable to admit that they've had an experience, and then the other is that some people genuinely do not remember or recall having had a near-death experience, but then they'll gain recall a few years after the fact.
That's right. Yeah.
So,
but for the artificial induction of a cardiac arrest, then we don't know, because now there have been hundreds of cases now, but we have to talk with these people to see how many really have been able to experience or recall an NDE, perhaps months or even years later.
Well, one thing that's gone on too that's also made it very difficult for people, once again, we're dealing with the materialists, and I was one such victim of this when I had what we refer to as a spontaneous recovery. In other words, it wasn't the doctors who brought me back to life, quote. There were half a dozen doctors on my case, and I made the mistake of telling one of the doctors, who was a male from India, that I had just been on a most tremendous journey, and straight away he said, I think you need psychiatric evaluation. Well, I shut down, you know. So I think the important thing is that if patients can know in advance that physicians and scientists are NDE friendly, as it were. In other words, if you let them know, well, if you have any experiences, please feel free to share them with us. You know, that you're friendly towards them rather than in denial of them.
Yes.
Because a lot of people are still very nervous about being open about the fact that they did have an experience, even though they did do. Fortunately, more and more people are starting to open up. As I said, it took me, you know, 20-odd years before I finally had my coming out, and I had my coming out in Nashville, Tennessee, USA, of all places, the buckle of the Bible Belt. But it was tremendous. It was just a spontaneous thing, and I wasn't ridiculed at all. People were very fascinated. And so I would personally like to see a lot more of this research going on, and physicians and scientists not being ashamed or nervous of just coming out there and saying, all right, we're doing this kind of research, like it or not. Because I think it's really important, again, to help eliminate the fear, because I know that's one of my goals, is to help people eliminate the fear of death. I think it's really important. And, you know, we're not just a biological computer or a robot, as you say. And I really appreciate that so many people have had these experiences that can say, wait a minute, you know, I was operating outside the confines of the physical body or the physical brain. A lot of us also did not hover over our bodies during our near-death episodes. In other words, we just shot far and away from the body and went deep into space, and and yet people were able to convey really accurate descriptions of different things that are deep in space that only astronomers could find out about and what have you. So I think it's a very powerful and legitimate and credible explanation of these things, and then when people like you can put it into scientific terms, and I think that bodes well for the scientific community. So by all means, I really commend you and Peter and Pam And you said Santania is working with you in this
workshop? Yes, on the standstill component of the project, yes.
Oh, interesting. Now, where is Dr. Santania located?
Well, he's based at Cornell. Yeah, so he's working at an hospital in affiliated to Cornell, but he also goes to UK quite a lot. So he shares his time, you know, between UK and New York City.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought he was in the UK a lot because it seems that in Britain there's a lot more openness to this kind of research.
Well, that's exactly what he tells me. Yes.
And in fact, of course, being from the UK, I'm in touch with people back home all the time. And admittedly, it's easier to talk to people back home than it is to talk to a number of people in America. There's still this sort of fundamentalistic, materialistic mindset going on, and it seems to me that it's fear that's, you know, disallowing people to open up and consider a different view or a different reality, which just seems strange to me, because it seems like the point of view that they currently hold is so fear-based, and I should think that people would want to be relieved from fear. And yet when they hold on to this kind of mindset, they're certainly not being, you know, experiencing relief from fear. So that, you know, logically speaking, and I like to think of myself as logical as well as being a mystic, what is the benefit of holding on to such a limiting point of view when it does still perpetuate a mindset of fear?
Right. Yeah.
So that is very, very interesting to me. Anything else that you would like to share with us?
No, I don't think so. I think we have covered the most important aspects of the work I'm doing.
Well, I really appreciate your being on Toward the Light this evening. Now, how can people get a hold of your book? Is that also on your website?
No, it's not on my website, because it's the website related to my university activities, my research activities. So they can buy the book through the through Amazon perhaps through other systems. That I'm not familiar with these systems, but I know for sure that Amazon sells this book.
Okay, well, I do have your book. Again, it's featured on towardthelight.org. It's a magnificent book, and it's also on the blog towardthelightorg.blogspot.com. And I will hotlink the book to the Amazon link so that people can purchase it directly, because I think it's really vital. And I'm so pleased with the work that you've done, Mario. You've done tremendous work, and I'm
thank you.
Grateful. And keep the spirit. This is wonderful, the work that you're doing here. And and certainly, if there's anything that I can do to help you,
well,
I'm more than pleased to do it.
Yes, well, we should stay in touch.
Absolutely, and give my love and regards to Dr. Simon Peter. I've done a bit of work with them in the past. They've been on this show. They're wonderful, wonderful people, and I'm so grateful to all of you for the work that you're doing. So please do keep it up.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye for now.
Cheerio now. We've been speaking to Dr. Mario Beauregard. He is the author of The Spiritual Brain. This is really, really a wonderful book. And I want to open up the lines. If anybody would like to call in and ask any questions, you're more than welcome to do so, because it's really paramount that we get the word out there and have a better understanding of the fact that consciousness does not come from the brain. The brain is not the author of our consciousness. It is really the transmitter of consciousness, just like a radio or television is. And so far, I've had a number of people on Toward the Light who have been talking about this, not the least of which is wonderful souls like David Icke, Dr. Peter Finnick, Dr. Pim Van Lommel, and now Dr. Beauregard. It's really wonderful that we are having people in the scientific community proving and validating, even in the laboratories, that consciousness is outside of the physical brain. So this is the important work of the near-death experiencer, of anyone who's had a near-death, out-of-body, or spiritually transformative experience. And indeed, one does not need to be on the verge of death or to experience physical death to have such a transcendent experience. And Dr. Beauregard actually conducted a test with Carmelite nuns. And nuns are ones who live a cloistered life rather than a secular one, so they have little to no contact with the outside world. Their work basically consists on prayer and meditation and contemplation and a lot of study. And I've also spent time in a monastery where I did this, and basically my life is very much like a nun. I'm a contemplative, and I do a lot of prayer and meditation and also research. And what's interesting is I could just be sitting at the desk or on the couch and just thinking about something, and suddenly I'm transported into another dimension. And I don't even try to invoke this experience. It just happens quite spontaneously. There are a number of people who have these experiences, and again, that's what is commonly referred to as a spiritually transformative experience, or STE. During these experiences, we have the experience of merging with all that is. We no longer have a sense of being separate. We just merge with the One. And the interesting thing about this is that we do not lose our sense of self. I didn't lose my Julietness, but I did lose ego. And there's a real vast difference between having the ego at the helm and having our true selfhood, which is really separate from the ego, operating. And when I had Andy Petrel on my show, he's a fellow near-death experiencer, and he was talking about his NDE that resulted from drowning. And he went into the light also, and he experienced this tremendous love and being completely one with all that is. Again, one can experience this just by being in an alternate state from meditation, or maybe you're playing music or doing something you love, or taking a walk in nature, as Mario experienced a lot. Mario Beauregard had experiences just being in nature, and of course nature is a wonderful conduit for rising to a higher vibrational frequency, moving into another dimension, and having this experience of being merging with all that is. And when this happens, we experience such a profound sense of peace and no fear whatsoever, because we move into a space of, we are in a space of deep knowing, deep wisdom, deep and unconditional love. So when we have this experience, there is no fear, because fear really doesn't exist in this kind of state. When we know the truth of what really exists and what is true, with unconditional love, we are in the state of peace. And the deep knowing that results from this state of peace and unconditional love, what happens is that we are in a place where we are moving at a very, very high vibrational frequency. Love is a very high vibrational frequency, whereas fear is a low vibrational frequency. And when we are in a place of fear, we are losing out on a lot of vital information. So that's when we start to shut down, and we're not really operating in a place of deep knowing. So that's when we start to feel panicky and frightened and this type of thing. But when we are in a place of unconditional love and peace, we are indeed in a place of knowing. We have the assurance that everything is happening and evolving exactly as it should. And there's no question that everything is going to be all right, that the light is at the helm, as it were. The light is in full control, and then everything is going to move completely back into a state of pure love, which again is a very high vibrational frequency. So this is what NDEs are working on, helping people to understand that death is just a transitional period. It is just letting go of the body, putting the body to rest, but what we find out is that our consciousness continues to exist in spite of the body no longer being in existence. So if the body is dead for just a few seconds, a few minutes, a few hours, a few days, or indefinitely, we do not cease to exist. And it is very beautiful what NDEs go through when they have a near-death episode. And for me, I was told that I did have to come back. Now, a number of people do have the choice to come back to the physical plane or not. Some of us do not have the choice. We are told that we need to come back to share a message. And also something that typically happens with NDEs is that we have a profound sense of purpose, of meaning with our lives. And also what happens as a result in the near-death episode for a lot of people is that they no longer are materialists. And who I had on my show recently was James Gilliland, who's an NDE. And he was what people would regard as a successful individual. He had the house and the car and the fulfillment of the American dream and all of that stuff, lots of money. But yet, as a result of his near-death experience, which also was from drowning, he lost all interest in materialism, and he pursued setting up an organization which enabled him to do research and to have contact with extraterrestrials. His research, his organization is Enlightened Contact with Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Again, as a result of having a near-death experience, people become more aware, people become more sensitive, they become less materialistic, they become imbued with the quest to serve others, to share love. There's no sense of fear of death. And people are very broad-minded, very loving, and very aware on a deep, deep level. So there are wonderful people who, as a result of having these experiences, some of which also include near-death-like experiences, which are, for example, if you're having an accident with your motor car and you feel like, oh my goodness, I'm going to die, but you don't actually die, so that will plunge you into a near-death-like experience where you can pop out of the body and have very similar experiences as someone who actually experiences physical death. So that is what is categorized as a near-death-like experience. Sometimes it's referred to as a close call because you think you're going to die, but you don't actually die. Then there's the out-of-body experience, which is quite common, and the spiritually transformative experience. So there's the near-death experience, NDE, near-death-like experience, NDLE, the out-of-body experience, OBE, and the spiritually transformative experience, STE. Now, a couple of other things that we've been discussing here with Mario and with Dr. Peter Finnick and Dr. Pim Van Lommel is the deathbed vision, which is referred to as DBV or DBP, standing for deathbed phenomena. These are experiences where people who are on the deathbed, and I've been on many of these myself, will have experiences where they're communicating with beings or loved ones, friends on the other side, and they've got very clear experiences, and yet they can also converse and have communion with people who are sitting with them. So it can be a loved one who is at their bedside or a caregiver or what have you. And they're very coherent. They're not at all behaving as someone does who is having an hallucination. Dr. Peter Finnick and also Pim Van Lommel, they pointed out the difference between one having a deathbed vision and one having an hallucination. Also the same with a near-death experience. When people have these experiences, as opposed to a hallucination, they're very clear in their thinking and their experiences. Also, the memories of these experiences remain fully intact even many, 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 many years after the event. So, again, we're really making huge headway in proving the validity of these experiences and the deathbed experience as opposed to hallucinations. Another interesting thing that happens during these experiences is that often a friend or loved one who is present with someone who is having a near-death experience or deathbed vision will have a spontaneous experience, like a spontaneous NDE or a spontaneous deathbed vision, where they share in the near-death experience. Well, I guess in this instance, it would have to be referred to as a near-death-like experience because the individual doesn't actually die but is participating in the near-death experience of the NDEer. And then they report back simultaneously having the same experience. So there's been a lot of documentation about this as well. So don't be surprised if you're, for example, a loved one or a caregiver working with someone in hospice. Pay attention to what the person is experiencing because it is very unlikely that it's a hallucination. It is actually something that one is experiencing on another dimension, a deathbed vision, or even maybe an NDE as well. Pay attention to the individual. Be mindful of what that individual is experiencing. Of course, you need to regard them very gently and maybe speak to them with a whisper, see if you get a response, and then see if that person is able to communicate with you in the moment. It may not be that one can communicate with you in the moment, but actually after the experience that they've had. So again, there are a lot of people who have NDEs and deathbed visions, and they don't actually stay dead. So these are very interesting events that do take place. And again, we've got people who are doing this research who are in the scientific and medical communities who are validating these experiences as being real and valid experiences. They are not hallucinations or the product of a dying brain. It is very important that people remain open-minded and very receptive and very loving, because the fact is that there is so much that is circulating out there now that is letting people know that we are indeed multidimensional beings, and we do not, in fact, cease to be when we leave our bodies behind. So pay attention. I encourage people to do your research, and there's a lot of good material that is out there. These wonderful doctors that I've been talking to haven't got websites, but you can find them on towardthelight.org. For example, Dr. Peter Finnick is towardthelight.org/peterfinnick.html. You can find out about the work that he's been doing and also listen to the archive show with him. Same with Dr. Pim Van Lommel. It's just towardthelight.org/PimVanLommel, PimVanLommel. And then the work that David Icke has done, he's on my website as well, and he's done tremendous work with this kind of research. So he's on my website, and also Mario is on my website too, who I just spoke with, Mario Beauregard, that is MarioBeauregard.html. So it's towardthelight.org/MarioBeauregard. www.thebuddhapodcast.html, and this show will be archived soon in a few days so that you can listen to the archives of these shows. These are really, really wonderful shows. We're getting the word out there, and I'm very, very grateful for this. And looks like, at least for now, we're not going to have any people call in. So what I'm going to do is I am going to close out this broadcast of Toward the Light Leading Back to Source. We were talking to Dr. Mario Beauregard, who is a neuroscientist, and he's been doing some tremendous work in validating the fact that we do exist outside of our brain. And he's the author of the book, The Spiritual Brain, A Neuroscientist's Case for the Existence of the Soul. So by all means, you'll want to look up that book. It is available through Amazon.com. It's a very brilliant book, and I'm very pleased that he's written this book. It's a good read. And next week, we are going to have Jonathan Harrison. He's a fellow near-death experiencer, and he's the author of the book, We Are All One. So we're going to be talking about his NDE and the work that he has done. And I think a lot of this, again, is going to be validating the fact that when we have these experiences, we actually come to know this experience of being totally one with all that is. And it isn't something you can hypothesize or come through logic. It is an experience that changes you completely forever once you've been through such an experience, feeling that complete oneness with all that is. And so remember that anybody that you are connecting with on any level, even if it's somebody that you don't particularly like, remember that that person is at one with you also. We are all a part of all that is. We cannot ever be separate except through the perception of the ego, which is a flawed one at best. So hopefully through all of this work that we are doing, people are starting to gain a better understanding of what the stuff is that we are made up of, and we are divine, that is our heritage, and that we are one with all that is. So hopefully that will bring a little bit of joy to your heart today, and it's been really wonderful serving you with this transmission of Toward the Light, leading back to the source. And do visit our website, towardthelight.org, and our other website, towardthelight.info. Again, next Saturday, 24th May, is our Light on the Water Near-Death Experience Support and Interest Group meeting via teleconference. Anyone who can ring a U.S. telephone number can participate in this meeting. All are welcome. It is from 9 to 11 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, so you don't want to miss that. Also, a reminder to everyone, we do have the Toward the Light directory. It is sort of like a phone book, a listing of experiences, researchers, caregivers, enlightened media, loved ones, anyone who is interested in this topic, even people who are doing seminars and workshops and retreat centers and what have you. Again, it's called the Toward the Light Directory, so you want to check that out. Go to towardthelight.org and click on TTL Directory. And please consider signing up for the directory. I think that you will really appreciate it. Lots of love and blessings to everyone. I want to remind you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. We will speak to you next week on another transmission of Toward the Light, leading back to the source. Love and blessings to all.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.